This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This episode, we're talking all things medication. We were really keen to have an episode where we talk all about medication and try and come at it from as many different angles as possible. Too often there seems to be a kind of medication debate, despite the fact that for so many, it's an invaluable resource really in helping them manage their mental health short term or long term. And so before we get into that, I've got a few stats. So first off, using data on every GP prescription dispensed at pharmacies in England, the number of antidepressants prescribed in England has risen sevenfold in the last 25 years. And that's from new analysis of NHS data from The Guardian. So that stat in particular, I really wanted to start off with to highlight how much medication is a growing situation. So wherever you fall in terms of what you believe about it, it's something that's increasingly being used by the NHS and increasingly being prescribed to people dealing with mental illness. Annie, do you have any initial thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. It kind of reminds me of, you know, people saying, oh, everyone's allergic to something these days, or everyone's got a problem these days, or everyone's gluten-free these days. It's like, people didn't used to be gluten-free in the 60s or 70s. Like, yeah, they did. They just didn't talk about it or understand what it was. You know, they just had that weird, frustrating, stiff upper lip thing that, you know, celiacs have always existed. That's always been a thing. So I wonder if the fact that the prescription of antidepressants of the NHS in the last 25 years has risen sevenfold. That's insane. I wonder if that's to do with the fact that people are talking more openly about mental health these days, not so much the fact that there's the need for it. And I mean, 25 years, the world's changed heaps in the last 5 years, let alone the last 25 years. I mean, that's just under my lifetime. Yeah. So from the beginning of the 90s to now, I mean, the world has changed in terms of technology and the demand and that really shitty attempt that we're kind of create a work-life balance that's just not doing very well at the moment. Like, we're all sort of taking work home, and because there's technology, we can check work emails from our bed at 6 o'clock in the morning when we should be relaxing with a cup of tea, you know? So I wonder if it's just that sort of demand on us technologically, and also that very odd right-wing rhetoric that working harder makes you a better person, when in fact I think we all know that it's better to work smart, not work hard. Hey, Bobs?
Yeah, I'm guilty of probably that last.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, no, like, Bob's is a very established and successful entrepreneur. So I was going to say, yeah, no, work smart, not work hard, for sure. There was, but anyway, yeah, but also I think it's probably down to the fact that people are talking more openly.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that it would be easy to read a statistic like that and think, oh, everyone's being drugged. But actually, it's going to be a whole range of factors. Like
Let's
you say,
that. Yeah.
Like you say, it can be, you know, that it's being talked about more, that more people are comfortable going to their GP and getting support, whereas previously they may not have done. It's also, I think, a reflection of a whole host of things, potentially how the rise of social media and the internet is affecting what people perceive as normal, you know, when all their friends are only posting the very best snippets of their lives.
Yeah.
You know, that can really contribute. It'll also be factors like how far antidepressants have come in the last 25 years.
Yeah.
It may be a case that for many doctors, even through their career, they're now changing the frequency to which they prescribe them because they're working better than they did before.
I'd be interested to know what the statistics are on Valium, because I know that Valium was very heavily overprescribed and is now considered extremely dangerous. You know, some people say that, oh, you know, my dad was on Valium, or what, it took him, you know, 20 years to come off it and feel right again. I'd be super interested to know
how
they tie in. Maybe we could look that up for another check-in at some point.
Sure, give me more work.
Myself more work, not you.
But no, that's a good point. That ultimately there's all these changes over the last 25 years. The world is a very different place.
Yeah.
And so whatever you think about medication, it's more a part of the world and more a part of people's mental health journey as a society than ever before. And so that's why we're really keen to do an episode like this where we really drill into medication and what that means for people. So another factor I wanted to talk about that we didn't get a chance for in the episode is how these statistics can vary regionally and also depending on wealth distribution as well. So these stats again are from The Guardian, who found in Northeast England, doctors made 1.73 prescriptions per person in 2016, whilst in the Southeast and London, the rate was 0.82 prescriptions per person. Also, using data on every GP prescription dispensed in pharmacies in England, they zoomed in on each district to discover the place with the highest rate of antidepressant use, and it turned out to be Blackpool, with 2.11 prescriptions issued per person last year. So worth bringing in there, according to the Department for Communities, Blackpool is one of the poorest districts in England, and this is judged using information on employment, housing, health, crime and income levels to monitor wealth distribution. So any thoughts on that?
I've been doing a lot of, I mean, I might be going off piste here, I don't know, reel me back in if I am, but I've been doing a lot of work recently on like beliefs about money for myself and how I view money and how that's sort of holding me back from earning more money. Basically, I don't deserve money. I come from a poor family, so I'll never have money. Not that I don't come from a particularly poor family, but I didn't come from money. You know, we were just comfortable, normal, if you like, if I say that word in inverted commas on a podcast. That it's really interesting that poor mental health correlates with low income. I really think it ties in with low self-esteem, which is something we've talked about quite a lot on this podcast. So yeah, I'm not surprised by that statistic at all.
Yeah, it's actually something that confirms a kind of thinking I have in terms of how where you fit socioeconomically can influence your perception on different things. So from my own kind of anecdotal experience, there seems to be more stigma towards medication for people that have more money. That there's this sort of thing of, maybe it is a self-worth thing of like, you're somehow better than that, that somehow you should be able to make do without medication because other areas of your life are more comfortable. Because that's what money is, really. It's just comfort. But then in contrast, it seems that there's less stigma when you go higher socioeconomically when it comes to counselling. And perhaps that's partly the fact that many people get their long-term counselling privately.
You have to pay a lot of money to have counselling. So it's almost like private counselling. So it's almost like a status symbol, isn't it? Like having a fancy car. It's like, oh yeah, I have a therapist.
Well, it could be almost normalised. That's something you see in friends and family, and therefore you're not going to have stigma around that. Whereas, like, I think anyone, there can still be the stigma about drugs. And so maybe that's, you know, that's a factor, because that's something I've seen quite a lot of. And it almost suggests to me here that the stats back it up, that the fact that in the most deprived area, they found to be the area with the highest prescription level, because maybe that's a factor that if it's normalized, if more people around you have those kind of prescriptions, then it's somehow more okay.
I don't have anything to add to that, really. I wish I did, but I agree with everything you've just said.
There are just a few points we wanted to start off with. We'll get into medication in far more depth in the interview with the brilliant Olivia Callahan. She's a online campaigner around mental health, body confidence, self-esteem. She goes by Self Love Live online. And she will talk us through a little bit of her own experience, and then we'll have a bit of a back and forth on different sides of the medication debate.
This week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending YouTube Famous, Making It Big on the Internet. This is a book I'm currently listening to with Audible to learn a little bit more about what it takes to get your content out there online. But whether you have a podcast to push or not, it's a really fascinating series of insights into different YouTubers. And it's incredible to learn how they've got the platform they do now, and it does like a case study about loads of different YouTubers, and you're guaranteed to have heard of at least a few of them. And as ever, you can get this book on Audible with your first one free if it interests you by following our link bit.ly/mentalbooks. The details are in the description.
Hello, I am Olivia. My mental health journey started when I was 14. Up until that, I had a great childhood. I was very happy, very calm. And then from 14 onwards, I became very isolated and very sad. And it kind of grew from there. When I was about 15 onwards, I started having what I call depression episodes, followed by a period of normality and then manic episodes from there.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, you weren't, I'm assuming, able to use such language. Were you?
I had no idea what's going on.
You had no idea.
Not a clue.
And you talked about being isolated there. Was that something that you realised was happening at the time?
No. In my head, I thought that every teenager was going through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And until I was probably 18, 19, I realised, okay, this is not quite as normal as I thought it was.
Yeah. No, that's something I've experienced a lot of, like particularly going to counselling. Mm. It's like an education in what is and isn't everyone's experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it works both ways. There can be so many things where you think it was just you.
Yeah.
And that's something that's been really fascinating with this podcast. There's so many people that have conditions I've never experienced. I'm like, yeah. Oh, but I can relate to all of these symptoms. Yeah.
When I was going through it, my mum presumed at first that it was a teenage thing. Until it was about 16 onwards, she thought, okay, this is more than just teenage hormones. This is something more serious. She would talk to other mums and dads of my friends and say, like, mm-hmm. look, have they experienced anything like this? And they'd go, no. And she thought this might be something a bit more troubling than just teenage hormones. So I went to a doctor when I was 18. And from there, I got diagnosed. And it's been kind of a bit of an up-and-down journey, really.
Mm-hmm. And what was that initial diagnosis?
Firstly, it was what's called cyclothymia, which is like mild bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
When I was 20, I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder type 2, which is like more depressive episodes than the mania.
All right. And what sort of symptoms were you experiencing at that point?
I was...
From 18.
From 18. I was very depressed. I was self-harming. I was suicidal. Wasn't eating properly. I would have what I call memory relapses, where I would just forget everything. So from now, I don't remember my 18th birthday, my 19th birthday, my 21st. Mm-hmm. No idea what happened then. I was very angry as well. I was angry with the world, angry with myself. Just constantly had this feeling of just like, I'm not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I can understand the crossover with just being a teenager.
Exactly.
You know, there's a lot of that self-esteem up yeah. and down that comes at the same time.
Yeah.
And so when you went to the doctor that first time, were you still feeling that this is something everyone was going through, or did you know it was something
I think
more?
From there, I knew something was going on because I was speaking to my friends about, I think it was just something silly like eating. And they were like, oh yeah, I had breakfast this morning, I had lunch, I had dinner. And I was like, I didn't, this is weird, like I don't do that. I struggle to have breakfast in the morning. And my mind tells me not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So why can they do it and I can't? And then from there, it was like the self-harming. I would look at people's arms in the street and they were absolutely fine. And from then I thought, okay, this is something not every teenager is going through.
Yeah.
This might be something I need to go and talk to someone about.
Yeah. And do you remember that initial appointment with the GP? How
yeah.
was that?
It was okay. I was very kind of like scared and nervous because from what my thoughts were that they weren't going to take me seriously. They were thinking it was my teenage hormones.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to think I was, weird or, you know, lock me up somewhere.
Yeah.
But then she was lovely. She was being very understanding. She went and offered me an appointment to a hospital where I went to get a diagnosis from there.
Okay. And so at the time when you got that first diagnosis,
yeah.
how was that? Did that give you some kind of clarity?
it was like almost like a relief. Mm-hmm. It was as if someone said to you, this isn't normal, but this is why.
Yeah.
It was like someone had just given me the answer after years of wondering what was going on with me. It was so like, oh my God, thank God. but at the same time, I was like, okay, what is this? And how do I control it? Is this curable? Can I live with this? What do I need to live with this? What do I need to do? So many questions came up from then.
Yeah, because it's that weird kind of good and bad. Because on one hand, it's a relief because you realise it's not just you.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. There's thousands of people affected. But then you're also like, oh, well, out of all those thousands of people, I know the least about it.
Exactly. I'm new to this.
And now you're like, oh, this is a whole new set of problems I didn't realise I had.
Exactly, yeah. Yay!
But no, for me, my first diagnosis was really helpful. But I think at that point, I knew there was something wrong. And so I'd done so much research.
Yeah.
And I'd gone, there's like a little NHS quiz that tells you whether or not you may have depression.
I've done that before, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, so many people have done it. And I remember doing that so many times. And each time I'd like change my answers. And I'd be like, okay, well, maybe if I'm exaggerating that one and that one. And every time I was still coming up depressed.
Yeah.
Each time it was saying, maybe go speak to a GP.
Go see someone, yeah.
So at that point it was kind of, similarly, I had that release of like, it's not just me, it's confirmed now, it's real, it's something that I can see and deal with.
That was the other thing, I presumed at one point it was all in my head.
Mm.
And I was imagining the whole thing, and I was normal, I say normal in brackets, but all these emotions weren't real. So to have someone say to me, you have an illness, was like, oh, okay, maybe I'm not like the perfect person, but who is, you know? And it was very relieving to have that diagnosis. Also very scary.
Yeah. And whilst that is a part of you and a part of your experience, it doesn't, I don't think, fundamentally change who you are.
No, it doesn't define me, not at all.
So you got your first diagnosis at 18 of cyclothymia.
Yeah.
At 20, you got bipolar type 2.
Yeah.
And what sort of options were outlined to you at the time?
One of the options was therapy, group therapy, which was very nerve-wracking because I don't do well with people. I'm a bit of a hermit crab. And the other option was medication.
And so I feel like I can guess which one you were drawn towards.
Yes,
then.
Definitely, yes. I was drawn to medication.
Yeah. And so in terms of group therapy, it seems to be something that's increasingly being suggested.
Yeah.
As like a bit of potentially a shortcut to get more people into counselling quicker.
Yes.
But I think whilst there are such great benefits to it, and it's definitely an option for many people, it's, as your first experience of therapy, it's quite full on.
Very full on, yes. I remember going to one and crying,
mm-hmm.
breaking down, because I was like in this room full of people who were pouring their souls out in a way. And they came to me and I was just like, I decided to cry.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving and not going back and just thinking, like, why would anyone do that to themselves? Like, it's so, like, I mean, it's good, but it's so nerve-wracking. It's the first experience in therapy. It's the first starting block. It's very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it sounds really overwhelming. And it's to draw, like, a parallel with a different service. Like, with AA, you don't get people going to AA until they admit to themselves they've got a problem.
Yes.
You know, and it's exactly. Like you just had the diagnosis and then they're trying to gear you towards this type of therapy where most of the time you're going in with people that have been there before,
mm-hmm.
or have already been in that same situation, yeah. and you're the new kid.
Exactly. And I think so for your first time into group therapy, talking about your problems is so difficult because mm-hmm. for years you've blocked them up and, you know, built this wall against, you know, society and life. To talk about your problems in the first time is so nerve-wracking, so scary, and so daunting as well. Oh,
yeah. Particularly when you're right at the beginning of your journey of understanding them.
Exactly, yeah.
And so instead you went for medication. So at that point, what did you know about the kind of medication options, if anything?
I knew nothing.
Yeah.
I knew that people with mental health problems were on medication. I knew nothing about the side effects, about what they did, how they helped. I knew nothing about that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I went on them that I knew more and more from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that, a little bit concerningly, I've heard quite a few people say they weren't talked through the side effects.
Yes. When I went to the hospital the first time, they put me on medication, I said to them, were there any side effects? They said, oh, no, you'll be fine. It's main ones like headaches and, like, you know, you might have trouble sleeping. When I went on the first dose of quetiapine, I gained so much weight from that that no one told me about.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, is this normal? Am I supposed to be doing this? Is this right? And I Googled it and it was a normal side effect, but no one told me about it.
Yeah, and it's so weird, like, that the onus so often ends up back on the patient.
Mm.
You know, because if it was something like, let's say I had, you know, medication for something physical, I can't really imagine that my first place would be Google to the same extent. Like, yeah. If I started having a weird side effect to, like, something that a lot of people are on, like a statin or a blood thinner, I'd be straight back into the hospital. Yeah. I'd be on the phone to the GP receptionist, like, what's going on? But it seems to be that maybe it's partly because when so many people nowadays experience mental illness for the first time,
yeah,
we go to Google.
We do, yeah.
Because it's this internal thing and there's potentially answers there. It's not like you can show a mate a bump and say, what do you reckon?
Exactly, yeah.
And then it seems almost that then you can go into the NHS system and start getting support, but then the onus is still so much on the patient, mm-hmm, to know what's going on as well.
Yeah. We're expected to do a lot more of the physical work than, say, a physical illness.
Mm.
So, you know, I was meant to know my medication did, know what my illness was, know a lot more about what it was doing to me. And I learned more from Google than I did from my doctor.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a concern. And so you started having side effects with that, and mm-hmm, so you looked it up on Google, it confirmed them. Yeah. What happened from there?
I was on quetiapine for about 2 years, I'd say, and it got to the point where I'd gained a lot of weight, which wasn't really a problem, but it was more the headaches, the constant tiredness.
Mm.
I'd take it at 7, and by 7:30 I was literally, like, asleep, passed out. Couldn't function. So I went out to my doctor and just said, look, this is not working for me. You know, I can't run this forever. And he said, okay, I'll try another one. And I was like, okay, well, what does this one do? Do you want to have the weight gain problem anymore? And I was like, okay, well, I still don't know what this one does. And it was a constant battle of finding the right one and finding the side effects that suited me in a way. And I felt like I was just constantly having to fight for medication that suited me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things where there's not even seemingly an ultimate authority on it, because mm-hmm, the doctor isn't going through your experience.
Yes.
They don't know to what extent the symptoms are livable.
Yes.
Because for some people, if they're already getting headaches may not be a problem.
Yeah.
Or if they're not so concerned about weight gain, it's not a problem for them. But I think that's the fine balance, because ultimately you're still the authority on what you can live with.
Yeah.
And what's worth the medication benefits.
Exactly, yeah.
And so we'll talk a little bit in the intro about stats around that, but there's still so many really common prescriptions for, you know, common mental illnesses, where even the doctors don't know exactly why it works.
Yeah.
And it can work for some people and not others.
For not others, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so you were saying then you were trying to fight for the right medication. So how did that go?
I eventually found one. I've been on aripiprazole for nearly a year and a half, I'd say. I'm now on the injection.
Mm-hmm.
So I get injected into me, which basically means that it's not a instant hit, it's a long-lasting release, which works for me, because with my medication I was on before, I was constantly up and down every day, not knowing what I was doing. With this one I'm on now, it's more like I'm more level, I'm more stable.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. And so was that something that was suggested to you, that you try the injection option?
The medication form the oral form, I should say, sorry, wasn't doing the job properly. And my doctor said, how about we try the injection form, see how that goes for a couple of months. And I've been on it for quite a while now. I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
But I suggest, like, going to your doctor first, definitely.
Absolutely.
Have a chat with them.
And I'm no doctor, but it does, on the surface level, seem to make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with bipolar, which inherently involves a lot of ups and downs. A
lot of emotion.
And those ups and downs being more long-term than many people realise. You're not switching on an instant.
Exactly.
It makes sense that you have a medication that is long-term as well, that acts slowly and more consistently.
Slow release, yeah, exactly.
Because it's interesting you mentioned about having the side effects of sleepiness with one of your previous prescriptions, because that's so common from what I've
read up. Very common.
To the point where I've known doctors of people I know recommend they have it in the evening to help with insomnia.
Yeah.
You know, it's the byproducts that are them being almost prescribed in themselves, which is quite weird.
It's very weird,
but I guess it's trying to make the best of an unideal situation because there isn't really a quick fix.
I think it's like you have to find the right balance that's best for you. Mm-hmm. There's no one's going to say to you, this is your perfect antidote.
Yeah.
I think you've got to find something that's best for you, whether it's medication, whether it's therapy, whether it's neither, you know. Some people don't use neither, and that's absolutely fine. It's about what's best for you, really, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And people love to, in headlines and in social media, bat around this idea of, like, happy pills.
Oh, yeah. They're not happy pills at all, because I still get depressed on them. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to have a pill that makes me so happy every day. I'd buy it in bulk, you know.
Well, everyone would be on it.
Exactly. For me, it just keeps me at a level where I'm able to enjoy life and not depressed and not being able to not get out of bed, not be able to wash myself, you know. Keeps me at a level where I can live.
Another thing I'm interested to hear from you about is this idea of pill shaming, how there can be really negative, like, connotations over taking medication, particularly more long-term seems to receive more discrimination. Have you experienced that?
Oh, yeah, from family members, from friends, from everywhere. I think people presume that if you take a tablet for mental health, it changes your whole personality. People wear glasses, people wear hearing aids, people use walking sticks, and it's just exactly the same.
That's such a good comparison.
It's just an insane thing, because it's something to help you live a normal life. You know, it's no different to one of them.
Yeah, it seems to, in the cases I've experienced, like, I've actually never been on medication for mental illness myself, but from what I've seen as an outsider, it often seems to be this weird sort of validation thing where people don't want to accept that you need the medication.
Yes.
Because in doing so, they have to accept that you've got a problem that they can't see.
Exactly, yes. I think with mental illness, unless you can't see it, people don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple as that. Unless you literally have a bump or a bruise or a sprain, people don't believe it's real. So when you take medication for something that people don't believe is real, it gets them confused as well.
Yeah.
And they think, well, I can't see your problem. Why should you take tablets for that?
Absolutely. And that's where the shame and the stigma makes it worse, because you feel this internal pressure to cover up.
Yeah, and to hide it.
Because you wouldn't, you know, if your arm's in a sling, your arm's in a sling.
You're not going to hide it, are you?
Because I still experience that quite a bit now, where people, even friends of mine, will not always get that. To be fair, having a podcast about mental health kind of helps me be an authority on this.
Yeah.
They believe me more now. But in the past, I've had quite a lot of experience where friends have been like, oh, but, you know, you don't seem depressed.
Yes, but you look so happy.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where I'm depressed on my own. I don't want you to see that. And I can almost feel a pressure to, like, oh, does this mean I have to literally, like, be around people when I'm feeling my worst, for them to get it?
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
Whereas that's the last thing you want to do.
Oh, the last thing, oh, yeah. Ugh.
You know, you only need to spend time around someone with a cold and see how much they apologise for being ill. You know, it's that classic British thing.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry that I'm ill.
Yeah.
As if it's their fault.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, yeah, it's interesting that you had that parallel experience with your prescriptions. And so what sort of things would people say to you when they're trying to...
Family members have often said, like, you don't need them. Have you tried going for a walk or taking a bath? I'm like, I've done both of them and still need my medication. So, yeah. I remember having...
And I'll just pause you there. Absolutely, those things can help.
Oh, completely help,
But it's for those to be even beneficial, to even kind of scrape the surface of helping you,
you
need to be at a baseline level of health.
Exactly, yes.
And that's where the medication
comes. If you're suicidal, a walk probably won't help you.
A bath may give you ideas.
A walk may give you ideas, you know? So, yeah. When I rang the crisis team one night and I was at a very bad place in my life, they suggested some really weird ideas. Like, they said to me, have you tried to talk to a friend? I'm like, yeah, that's great, but I'm suicidal. I'm talking to you. I felt like they were passing on my problems to someone else. And they were the help that I needed, but they wanted to pass on to someone else. And I thought that was just...
And it's so difficult to know what to say.
Very difficult, yes. I agree with that.
You know, I've worked in Samaritans and I've obviously had my fair share of talking to people about mental illness, you know, through the show or through friends. But there's always, you know, you always have times where you're stumped and you don't know what to say.
Yes.
I remember with Samaritans, the first time... someone told me about a bereavement and they'd lost their partner, and there's nothing I can say for that. Nothing I can say
to make them
changes
go, oh,
it.
Yeah, for great now.
And I managed to talk it through a little bit with her, but I felt like I hadn't said the right thing.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a supervisor afterwards. We have like shift leader in Samaritans who you go to. And he said, well, often all they want to do is just talk about that person.
For you to listen.
Yeah. And so, you know, if I ever had a call like that again, then I'd just say, oh, well, do you want to tell me about them?
Yeah.
Because the really sad thing is that for many of them, they have that parallel experience where people are like, oh, well, you know, we can't change it. We've got to move on.
Yeah.
And people don't allow them the space to talk about someone that's gone.
To grieve properly.
Yeah. And actually, sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah.
You just need to be able to, like, you know, the other day I saw this insignificant thing, but it made me think of them and I want to talk about it.
Same as mental illness, really. Like, sometimes all we need is a friend to talk to, just to get our worries off our chest and just someone to listen to us. We don't want the answers. We don't want this great, fascinating white light of hope. We just want someone to listen to us and say, you know what, I'm here for you. Let's have a chat, let's go for a coffee.
Yeah, absolutely, because that's a validation in itself.
Yeah.
That what you have to say and what you're experiencing is worth being heard.
It's valid, yeah.
It makes such a difference. This is a bit ridiculous, I even listen back to this podcast sometimes and I find it really reassuring. Like, I obviously have to technically listen back to it for editing, but I'll listen back to it sometimes if I'm on a train and I'm feeling a bit shit and I've got time to kill.
Yeah.
And I find it so reassuring just hearing back things I already know.
Yes.
And so when you were experiencing this, may I say, kind of backlash almost from friends and family of you taking medication, taking it in longer term, were you able to communicate to them?
I think my mum had a great idea. She just said, you know, like I mentioned earlier, it's no different to people wearing glasses or hearing aids. Mm-hmm. It's something that helps them. This is something that helps you. You know, just don't worry about it. And, you know, my mum's a great supporter in mental health. She's a great person in my life. And she would always be like, have my back, have my corner to fight. And because it's exactly that. It's no different than people who take medication for diabetes or, you know, blood thinners. Why should we feel shame for taking something for mental illness?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, the irony is it's in the best interests of everyone. Because
exactly.
Particularly conditions like bipolar, when they can affect your mood so dramatically, it helps you have better relationships.
Exactly. Everybody wins.
And actually, you know, you mentioned before of people thinking that it changes you, but actually it helps you be yourself.
A better version of yourself, yeah.
And so you're now on long-term medication.
Yes.
Are you finding that now that you're on the medication and you're on the injection, the right one, that that's relatively stable, or are there still side effects?
There's still the odd day where I feel very low and the odd time where I feel a bit, you know, down, depressed. But overall, compared to how I was, you know, 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I feel great. I feel like a better version of me.
Yeah.
I feel like the person I was when I was younger, with an added sense of bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still the person I am today. I still live, just with, you know, those side effects.
Yeah, absolutely. The irony is I have this experience myself of where I don't, you know, I try not to regret things as much as possible. Yeah. And even though the more you kind of think about it and the more you have counselling, you can start to draw possible reasons that contributed to mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
I try and not regret it because ultimately I've learned a lot more about myself.
Yes.
Through understanding what I'm like when I'm not myself.
Exactly, yeah.
And you have counselling as well yourself.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through now, that's just one-on-one, isn't it? It's not...
One-on-one, yeah. Not group therapy,
so
no.
So not brave enough for that.
No, not brave enough for that, yeah.
And so could you talk us through when that came about and what that experience was like?
So I was offered one-to-one therapy 10 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing 10 sessions. And it's just nice to have someone listen to you and, you know, not judge you, not feel like you're being a burden, not feel like you're being, you know, wasting someone's time. So it's nice for someone to go, have a seat, let's chat. I'm okay, today was great, or today was crap, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's incredible, even just the power of having someone where their whole job is
to listening listen to you.
To you. And not just that, but listening to this specific part of your life.
Yes.
That so often you can question yourself for talking to other people about.
Yes.
It can be, I find it personally so freeing just to be like, okay, I need to go to that place and tell you all the things I'm struggling with.
Yeah.
And that's what you're here for.
Exactly. See, I find therapy quite raw, quite emotional, because I think therapy in itself is a way of stripping down to your darkest part of your soul. And for them to go, that's okay, tell me more. It's like, whoa. Because for so many years, I spent in my bedroom, not telling a single person what's going on with me.
Mm-hmm.
For someone to say to me, I want to know anything about you, is just like, it's huge. It's very freeing, very, very therapeutic, excuse the pun. And it's very just, it's just lovely. Mm. I love my counselling.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that, you know, clearly I have no problem speaking about mental illness, but at the same time you still feel that pressure in the
back
of your mind.
Still little parts of you that stop you from saying certain things, I find.
And you want to put a sort of golden spin on everything. And so that's part of the same thing of, you know, you don't tend to be around other people when you're at your worst.
Yeah.
You catch it with them later and you say, oh, but it's all right now.
Yeah, lol, no.
Yeah.
Right now.
And there's, you know, there can still be that pressure. And so it's, you know, it's such a help to have someone where you don't have to say any of that.
You don't have to pretend to be something you're not.
Yeah. And that's it, because it's, you know, it's honest that all of these things, all of these experiences, all of these moods are still part of you.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, things like depression, I think, is possibly one of the most relatable mental illnesses for people that don't have it.
Yeah.
Because everyone knows how sadness feels.
Exactly.
And it's a, you know, it's a different branch of that same feeling. It's interesting what you said about counselling being really raw, because it's like that parallel with the happy pills.
Yes.
You know, you don't come out of a counselling session always feeling super empowered. Sometimes you feel really quite left on a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Or very vulnerable, I find. Like almost weak, because you've poured all your emotions out to one person, and then you leave and you're just like, I need a nap.
Yeah.
I need a rest. I'm tired.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes you glad that it's only an hour.
Literally, yeah.
But no, I think that's an important point, that it's not a motivational
Pep talk.
It's not a public speaker. It's a completely different experience.
Exactly.
You know, I'm so glad they exist.
And me, so glad.
Okay, so we'll start rounding up there. Mm-hmm. And I'm really keen for you to tell us all a bit more about like the advocacy work you do now, which is super inspiring.
I run a mental health account called Self Love Live, where I talk about my experience of mental health, mental illness, body confidence, self-love. Mm-hmm. It's just a safe space, really, for everyone who feels a bit like they're on their own, because they're not on their own, you know? You've got me.
Yeah.
When in doubt, you've got me, you know?
Yeah, and it can just be so reassuring. That's something that is really wonderful that I've learned through doing this, how great the online mental health community is.
It's so great.
Like, it seems like everyone knows everyone.
Yeah.
It's really quite incredible. So I love your account.
Thank you. Annie,
our assistant, has been following you for ages.
I know, she said it to me. I was like, oh, God, hello.
Yeah, you're meeting a real-life fan.
So lovely.
So, yeah, definitely go follow Liv. And if you want any kind of... just a pick-me-up, really. Just a bit of positivity. Absolutely. And so you are Self-Love Live, all one word, on Twitter and Instagram.
That's correct.
Great. Okay. And so we're almost out of time. Is there anything else you wanted to kind of sum up on before we go?
I think end of the day, do what's best for you, whether it's medication, therapy, counselling, talking, do what's best for you. Don't let anyone force you to do anything you don't want to do. Just do you, booze.
Absolutely. And it's none of those are exclusive. You can try more than one medication.
Exactly.
You can try counselling at the same time.
Yeah.
For everyone, it's going to be your own combination that works for you.
It's like a balancing act to find the right balance between the two.
Absolutely. And it's something that no doubt, you know, changes in parts of your life.
You know.
I've known people that have, you know, had medication or counselling or other support. And then, you know, they've gone through a bereavement and they've had to go back.
Start again.
And it brings up a lot of old feelings.
Yes.
It's not always even just about the bereavement.
Yeah.
You know, we all need a bit of extra support for different reasons at many points in our lives.
Exactly.
So, yeah, remember that, you know, we're lucky to have a free NHS.
Yes.
It's always going to be there for you. Grand. Well, thank you so much for joining us
today. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.